Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. You don't have a sling.
I am slingless for the first time in about 6 weeks.
How's Dr. Eric?
Dr. Ricchetti is doing very well, and even better than that, from my perspective, he says my collarbone is healing nicely, and he's given me the green light to do some range of motion exercises.
That is awesome.
Yeah, I feel like the Tin Man right now.
Yeah,
from the Wizard of Oz.
Would you like a little squeaky oil?
Oil on
your squeaky joints?
Yeah.
So, I can get you some T9 or some ProLink or something or some Finish Line.
I might need some high-end chain lube for this shoulder because it's a little stiff.
But, well, it was nice seeing you walk into the studio without the sling this week.
It feels so good already, and good to know that things are progressing along. So
yes.
I have no complaints at all.
And, how nice is that?
And, you know, we had some crappy weather this week, and
yeah.
Now the weather's good again. So, you know, who
Go
can complain?
Nobody here in this studio can complain.
That's right. That's right.
This is going to be a good show, though.
Okay.
We have two great guests, and in the ongoing effort to bring some great gift ideas to listeners, we'll be talking with Amy Walker about her new book. Amy Walker is one of the founders of Momentum Magazine and the editor of her new book, On Bicycles, 50 Ways the New Bike Culture Can Change Your Life. It's getting lots of rave reviews on Facebook and some other places. Steve Belinke, our buddy from Philadelphia, calls On Bicycles the whole earth catalog of bicycle culture. In his eloquent little piece, it's really nicely written at the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Ellie Blue?
Mm-hmm.
From Portland. She was our guest last March. She's a contributor to the book and had this to say about Amy. I was an admirer of Amy's work with Momentum for many years. In 2010, she invited me to write a city profile of Portland for Momentum magazine. Working with her on that, as well as my contributions on bicycling, was a pleasure. She's a thoughtful and generous editor, and it's clear that her primary motivation is to empower and inspire readers with the story of bicycling.
Nice.
It's a nice book. Yeah. So we're going to get to Amy a little later in the show. And our first guest tonight is a frame builder.
Okay.
His name is Steve Garrow of Coconino Cycles in Flagstaff, Arizona. By his own account, Steve is, quote, the most damaged person you are likely to ever talk to, unquote. And I was really shocked when I read that. But he was hit by a truck while riding his bike.
Wow.
Yeah. So he's going to probably tell us about that. Also, by his own account, though, he says that while he was severely damaged during that accident, it does not define who he is or what he does. And I think you'll be real surprised at that.
Good for him.
Yeah. He started out one tough hombre.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he still kayaks and rows and mountain bikes. And he builds some pretty sweet frames. Hmm. So he's about as one-off as they come, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. So we'll have some news. And we'll talk probably a little bit more.
Okay.
To round out our hour. So let's welcome Steve Garrow to The Outspoken Cyclist. Steve, thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, you're very welcome.
This is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever done a radio interview before.
Really?
No, I don't think so.
Well, there's always a first time for everything. All right. So I need to know, pronounce the name of your company, which evidently is also your county.
Coconino.
Coconino.
Yes,
okay.
It's Coconino County, Coconino National Forest.
I got
Coconino it. Coconino Plateau. It's all Coconino here.
And it's basically the Flagstaff, Arizona area.
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
You're south of the Grand Canyon, north of, say, Sedona.
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We got that out of the way. So I think you have probably one of the most interesting backstories of frame builders of anybody I've ever met. And you've said some things, you know, in our conversation back and forth in email, and I'm like, holy smokes. So why don't you fill us in a little bit on your background, where you grew up, and how you kind of started out on your own when you were 16?
Yeah, I grew up on an Indian reservation, actually, in northern Arizona. And grew up there in, like, a totally different culture. My dad married into the tribe when I was, like, 11. And I just didn't really jive with the whole family thing and started running away. And that kind of, precipitated into running away for about 4 months and being a cowboy with the Indians. Then that didn't really work out very good with family matters. So I basically wrapped up high school and hit the street on my own at 16.
And so where relative to Flagstaff was, and I think it was Tuba, Arizona?
Tuba City.
Where? How far away is that?
75 miles northeast of here.
So you sort of got dumped out on a street corner and said, get a job.
Literally.
Really?
You nailed it. Yeah, $20 in a duffel bag. You nailed it.
And so what was your first job?
I was a fry cook. There's room to move as a fry cook.
And you're still cooking today. See that? Some things work out.
I still cook.
Yeah.
I still bike.
Yeah, and that's very cool, too. So you've been a firefighter. You've been a cook. You've been a tree trimmer.
Yep.
Mountain biker.
Yep. Baker, stonemason.
Jeez.
Yeah, anything that would make a buck. Metal fabricator, bike mechanic.
So let's start with that bike mechanic thing. You actually became part owner of a bike shop.
I was.
And you learned very quickly that you can't make any money doing that, right?
Well, oddly, the entire time I've been working on bikes since, I think, 1989.
Yeah.
I always said, I will never be that guy, the bike shop owner. And then I ended up being a bike shop owner.
It's tough.
It was really difficult. And the most difficult part was I was just in a partnership with someone who I had been a friend with for many, many years, and we had never tried to be partners together, and it just did not work out. So, I'd been working with metal in the off season a lot and done art my whole life. So it seemed like a natural, accumulation of having, started out as, the flat repair kid and worked all the way up to, being a bike shop owner. And then I was just like, I just really want to merge all of my talents and had always wanted to do this. And then, I was like, well, at a dead end. And so I finally just put the pieces together and took the leap and started putting it all together.
So you also did a lot of riding all over South America and all over the West.
Yep.
Were you doing all this on your own?
Largely, either that or whoever I could muster to actually go on any of the harebrained adventures. Sometimes I even returned with them.
So what kind of bike were you riding in those days?
Whatever the current bike du jour was, I would go through them fairly regularly.
Okay.
I was riding probably about 10,000 miles a year.
Wow.
I've never driven a car in my life.
And you still don't drive a car?
No, I don't, especially now.
Oh, well, that's true. We'll get to that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's very cool. I have a son-in-law who's never driven a car.
Yeah, I had never needed it, and it was never in the budget.
That's fine. As long as you can get what you need, believe me, car culture is not all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I don't feel like I suffered nor missed out.
I'm sure. In fact, I think you probably ended up on the right side of that equation.
Yeah.
So you seem like a pretty natural athlete.
Yeah, I was just, and when you ride bikes all the time and bike tour all the time, you've got, tons of miles underneath your belt.
But you also raced the bike.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
How long were you racing?
Oh, from 1986 until 2005.
And is that when your accident occurred?
Exactly.
Okay. Do you want to tell us about it? And we won't dwell on it, but just tell us what happened.
Well, I was hit by a 67 Chevy pickup truck at least 45 miles an hour on my bicycle.
Where were you?
Going to my friend's house for dinner.
Oh, I thought you were in the middle of a race.
No.
Oh.
No, I was riding to my friend's house for dinner. Just one of those riding cross town things.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you ended up in the hospital for quite a while.
Yes. I broke my neck at C4, C5. I broke my spine at T11, T12, all of which are fused. I broke 7 ribs. I blew my femur into 25 pieces. I split my liver in 2, split both my kidneys, tore my ureter, punctured one of my lungs. I was a total mess, of course. I looked like I'd been run over by a truck.
Really?
Yeah, almost bled out there, and they took me into the emergency room where my wife had just checked out from work.
Oh, she works at the hospital?
Yeah, dressing room, yeah.
Oh, what does she do?
She's a nurse.
Oh, well, at least you have had excellent care all this time. So how long did it take you to recover to where you are today?
Oh, years.
Okay.
That being said, I got hit on October 5th, 2005, and I went to work on Christmas Day, 2005, back frame building.
All right. How the hell did you do that?
I was in a coma for 10 days. I went directly from the coma to ICU, and within 2 days of waking up, I was in rehab.
Uh-huh.
Because I was driving everybody crazy. I told them I had to do something, and I wanted to start getting better.
And obviously, you have gotten better enough to get back on a semblance of a bike?
Yes, I do off-road hand cycling.
And you row, and you kayak?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You're pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And tough.
I have a farm.
Well, you have a farm?
Yes.
So you guys grow a lot of your own food?
We keep it at fruit trees.
Nice.
Yeah. No annuals. Stick with perennials.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this planting every year thing, you know, forget that.
Exactly.
All right. Let's talk about frame building a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And that is basically your income?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about Steve Garrow's frame building philosophy.
Well, it's just me. I work by myself, and I've always worked by myself, and I'm pretty much always going to work by myself from here on out.
Okay.
I'm not good at telling people what to do, you know? And if I have to check it over, I might as well done it because I've already, you know, done it twice. So
exactly.
It's just me. So,
okay.
You know, my frame building philosophy is pretty much, you know, just I try and build people bikes they like in a timely manner and responsibly, and it seems like a pretty basic job premise, I would say, you know?
What is your basic material? Do you use steel mainly?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else?
No.
Okay. And
yep.
Are you brazing frames, welding frames?
I fillet braze frames.
Okay.
And I do some lug components, but mostly 90% fillet brazing.
I think a lot of people think that all you build are mountain bikes, but that's not true, is it?
I build mountain bikes. I build world touring bikes because I just build things I know. I know ultra endurance racing. I know single track riding. I know world touring.
Tell me about ultra endurance racing.
Yeah, I raced. You know, the usual. I call them small races, but you know the series races and such for years and years. Here in Arizona, we would race. You know, Arizona, and then Colorado is right next door. New Mexico has some old races, and we'd go to Mammoth or Park City. It's pretty, you know, central. Or Phoenix, you know, the racing season starts in January and goes all the way through the fall. So I got tired of that and moved on, and plus I'd been touring all these years, so I had great base miles. So I figured, well, let's, you know, up the ante and moved on to 12-hour races.
Got
50
it.
50-mile, 100-mile, 24 hours.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you do brevets and stuff like that? I mean, were you, like, training for things like PBP or
any of... No, strictly off-road.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, like the Continental Divide thing.
I really wanted to do that one, and I never did get the chance.
Yeah. There was a what was the movie? The Great Divide? Was that the movie?
Yeah. It didn't work out for my whole master plan in that I would wrench on bicycles all summer.
Yeah.
And then it's a ski town at 7,000 feet, so I would get either laid off... Or go touring. You know, I get laid off and go touring, or I would, if it was, you know, I would do alternate years to, you know, go on a big tour somewhere in the world. So if I was here for that winter, I would do metal work all winter.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Steve Garrow from Coconino Cycles in Flagstaff, Arizona. So how many frames are you building a year, approximately? I mean, obviously it changes from year to year, but...
Right around 30.
Wow, that's quite a number more than one.
Yeah.
You know, that's more than two a month.
Most of them have forks. A good 50% have handmade forks. And then I build tons of wheels on top of all that. And then components, so full bikes. And then I sell custom-built wheels as well.
So tell me a little bit about what you like in componentry today. Do you like the Altegra stuff, or do you like... Are you still using lots of bar end shifters? What are you doing?
Oh, boy. Bikes just run the entire gamut here. There's no set thing. You know, within each of those, you know, different types, you can have, like, a bike with, like, XT cranks and Altegra bar end shifters.
Okay, got it.
You know, so it's kind of just, it's just custom from the get-go.
Who is your average customer?
Average customer is going to be, I would have to say, actually, straight up front, that a third of my clients are women.
Yes, very good.
Yep. And so I'm going to say, given that demographic out of the way, I'm going to say that they're going to be somebody from 35 to 60.
Okay.
It's not their first bike. They either want to ride more comfortably off-road, or they're going on a world tour. And I'm going to say that's going to be like the bulk of the people that I deal with. Either that or like a commuter bike.
Uh-huh.
I do a lot of multiple bikes. People will get a mountain bike and they'll be like, okay, I want a touring bike.
Right.
And I've probably only built maybe 10 real road bikes in my time building, and those have all been for people I've already built bikes for.
Do you build racks?
No. Sometimes, but not really.
Okay. Okay. So, well, when you talk about touring and world touring, obviously they need racks because they've either got panniers or they might have a trailer, but
yeah.
For the most part. How about fenders? You put fenders on bikes?
If people want, yep. I just made a bike with a bunch of handmade fender mounts on it. They were really pretty snazzy. The current one has that. I'm building an S&S coupler bike right now.
Oh, cool.
That's going to go all around the world. I know he's going to take it to South America pretty off the bat. I just finished a frame and fork and a rack, actually, that are going to North Carolina.
So you already lied to me about the racks. Okay.
I know. I'm terrible that way. Be careful what you say. People will want them.
That's
been the way it's went the whole time.
I know what you mean. How long is the wait for a frame?
Excuse me?
How long is your wait for a frame?
It's between 11 and 12 months, and that's been static now for about 8 years.
Huh.
It just keeps it right about, I just maintain the same plane, it seems like.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I like that. Build one, get it ordered. I like the, keeps just a good momentum.
When somebody says, okay, I want one of your frames, what's your process?
Well, basically, first of all, I go through some questions to make sure that we're both talking about the same thing.
Well, that's a good idea.
Like, okay, you're not looking for somebody to build you a track racing bike, right?
Right. Right.
You know, or something like that. You know, just be like, okay, what are you basically looking for here? You know, just because I build several kinds of bikes and they're vastly different, you know.
Sure.
I build a lot of actually 26-inch wheeled mountain bikes now because a lot of people eschewed those, but they're still widely loved, especially, you know, people who aren't that tall. The majority of women, I'm still building a lot of 26-inch mountain bikes. So, you know, or if someone asks for a 29er, you know, before I commit to it, I'll be like, you know, how tall are you?
Right. I'm 4'9".
Yeah, I mean, right. What are we doing here? And is it both a project that we're going to be happy with the outcome mutually? You know, and before we even get into great details or, you know, how's your saddle set back or anything like this, we got to determine first that we're going to, you know, undertake a project we're both going to be happy with.
Sure. I understand.
And then it goes, you know, pretty straightforward. Okay, if you're really took progress from here, you know, just send me a deposit and then give me your measurements. Let me look those over. We'll talk components. And throughout the next 11 months or so, we'll finally congeal a thought and we'll make it happen.
How often does somebody come out to you and say, do my measurements here? Or is it most of it done either through the internet or through a phone call? Or how do you work with that fit?
Either or. You know, I think maybe a quarter of my sales are in Arizona.
Okay.
And so usually those people are going to just come here anyway because we're a cycling destination.
Sure.
Especially in summer with mountain biking. And even in the winter, Sedona's only 28 miles away and 4,000 feet lower. So there's cycling going on all year. So
got
they'll
it.
Just make doing a shop tour and stopping in part of the thing. Or people will send in their measurements, which works really fine. We just have to talk to each other and make sure we're understanding the same language.
Okay.
And then there's a lot of people that come and pick them up.
Oh, very cool. So you can do your final fitting with them there.
And they make it like a vacation kind of ordeal, and
sure.
They come out, and you know, and then they go out bike riding, and we even have a test trail from the house and everything, so.
Do you do any suspension mountain bikes?
Not rear suspension, front shocks.
Okay, and whose shocks are you using these days?
You know, usually Fox with the default. People seem to either be a Fox or RockShox.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Largely Fox.
Yeah.
They're pretty nailing it really good lately. That's some good suspension there.
Yeah, see, I don't know as much about mountain biking. We basically are a road shop. So, you know, it's nice to hear that somebody's still building a lot of nice mountain bikes. Do you have any new projects coming up, something different from what you're doing, or are you just going to keep doing what you're doing?
You know, this is funny. I'm so resistant to change. All of my socks have matched for, I think, 30 years now. They're like all the same wool ones. I'm kind of famous for that. Like, I don't really change. I just keep trying to perfect my gig. And not really. I see, you know, people are like, aren't you doing anything new? And I'm like, well, every bike is new to me because every person is new.
That's right.
So I feel constantly challenged.
Well, I think that's awesome.
You know, I mean, I don't need a new product. Every product is new.
Right.
You
well,
know, it's a blank slate for every project.
I guess the only thing that sort of stays the same is some of the componentry. I mean, you don't have as many choices there, but obviously every frame is built for a very specific person, so it is new.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been really excited about lately is I've been working with True Temper to draw tubing for me.
Oh, good.
Because if you've seen my bikes, they're curved. All the stays are swoopy. The top tubes are curved.
Right.
I manipulate all this stuff, and so there had been a real glut. One of the guys who was importing the tubing that I used finally retired at 93.
Well, I don't know. He probably could have gone on a few more years. Who was that?
His name was Charles Vogelsong, and he started importing aircraft tubing after World War II, where he was a pilot.
And from where? Where did this tubing come from?
He was from, I believe, Pennsylvania.
And where did the tubing come in from?
He would source it. He had the power to, he would stock over 1 million feet of tubing.
Wow.
And in an old, I believe it was a chicken factory. And so he had the power to order enough to get it actually drawn to his spec.
That is very cool.
He quit. You know, he finally retired. He still wanted to go on. I guess his wife convinced him to retire and enjoy his later years.
That is very cool.
I hope he's enjoying his retirement.
Yeah. So you had to obviously find a source for tubing.
Yes, exactly. And it's I'm really excited about it because the product that they've been making here in the United States is really, really nice. So a lot nicer than I'm used to using.
Wow. Better yet. All right. What are you doing for Thanksgiving?
A bunch of my missus's family are coming out from Wisconsin.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm. And
because it's probably going to be cold.
We're just going to hang out, and we'll be down. My shop is at 7,000 feet, and my farm is at 3,000 feet, and they're only 40 minutes apart.
So it's all downhill
we'll be down
from there.
And here it's going to be the lows will be in the teens, but then down there, only 40 minutes away, it's going to be 70 degrees.
Wow! So that means you could go for a bike ride.
Yeah, probably either that or boating.
Boating. Yeah, I saw a really cool picture of you and I assume your wife in a kayak, maybe?
She's about the only one I will trust me to get in one, yeah.
Yeah, Brian and I tried it once and we said never again. We ride a tandem together, but I'm sorry. The kayak thing just didn't work out for us.
Yeah, no matter where a relationship's going, we'll get there faster in a tandem.
That is exactly what we tell people. Do you ever build tandems?
No, I just simply do not have the fixture. And that's another one where I'll just default to the experts.
Got it.
Yeah, there are people who have that down.
Well, it's nice to know your strengths.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and obviously
exactly. You
have some. Well, you know what? You're fun.
Thanks.
I'm going to let you go fix dinner, and I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us this evening.
Oh, no worries. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for giving me the opportunity.
Why don't you, before we hang up, tell us what their website is if people want to learn about Coconino Frames.
It's very simply CoconinoCycles.com, which is COCONINO, Coconino Cycles.
And you have a nice blog, too.
Yes, I've been working on it for like 6 years. I think I have almost 5,000 pictures on there.
I didn't have time to go through all of them, but the one that I like is the one right on the front page because it reminds me of our shop.
Dark and dreary?
No. No, just you kind of peering at that frame from that angle, you know. I can see Brian doing that kind of thing. So it's
I build in a wheelchair, so that's my height.
That works for me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Steve, have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much again.
You bet.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Steve Garros of Coconino Cycles joined us from Flagstaff, Arizona, where he builds frames and does fruit farming and a few other things.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's either 10 degrees or 70 degrees, depending on your current elevation.
Exactly. Up it's cold, down it's warm.
What a story. Boy, he had a horrific crash, and yet he's come back, you know.
2 months?
Yeah.
He was like, put me in rehab now.
Makes me look like a total wimp, my little one broken bone. He had every bone in his body broken.
Pretty much. Wow. That's what it sounded like, yeah. And so he builds frames in a wheelchair.
Wow.
He did get up on, he can get up on crutches and walk a little, but it's an effort. But you know what? Obviously, it doesn't stop him.
Not at all.
At all.
All right.
I think it's cool.
Hey, we've got just a little more time before we take a break at the top of the hour here. You got a little news bite?
I do.
Okay.
So we sort of alluded to the fact that, you know, while we're ramping up towards the holidays, we're each week we have something that could be a nice gift for a cyclist.
Okay.
Well, here's another one. I'm not real sure if I want one of these in my house, but maybe you do. If you're waiting for the Cycle Passion 2012 calendar, wait no more. According to Bike Radar, big surprise, the calendar featuring top female cycling stars in seductive poses, photographed by Daniel Geiger, is in its seventh year. This is the first time I've heard of it, though. Its makers say they've gone for a slightly different concept this time round with, quote, more focus on the individual athlete, unquote. Each month is double-sided, meaning there's a posing shot on the front with action shots or legs, plus an athlete bio on the reverse. Shooting the calendar took the Cycle Passion guys all over the racing circuit. The riders featured are cross-country racers Pauline Ferrand-Prevot, Hannah Klein, Catherine O'Shea, and Maya, and I don't know if I can say this one. You probably can because it's one of those sort of Polish-type names, Lithuanian-type names.
Yeah, it's definitely Polish.
Okay.
Wolszczowska?
Okay.
That's
as close as we're probably going to get. And road racers Veronica Andreessen, Liz Hatch, and Marion Rousset. The calendar is available now from Cycle Passion's website.
Wow.
Oh, you want one, huh? Yeah, maybe.
At the risk of sounding sexist, Liz Hatch is hot.
Okay.
I don't know about any of those other women. I'm sure they're quite attractive as well, but Liz Hatch is definitely, yeah.
Okay, then.
She can adorn my wall
anytime.
Is there a counterpart to that for the female cycling enthusiast?
Not that I know of.
No pictures of the male cyclists, huh?
There are plenty of pictures of male
that's
cyclists
true, there are.
All
that's,
year round.
That's true, there are.
You know, Lycra, Lycra, Lycra.
All right, what's the website for information on that?
Cycle Passion, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sure. Cycle Passion 2012. You'll find it.
All right, I will do that.
I think it is cyclepassion.com, actually.
Probably.
Yeah.
Okay, on that note, let's take a break.
All right.
Fan ourselves here in the studio for
you
a minute.
You can fan yourself.
And when
one arm.
When we come back, we'll talk about a new book on bicycles.
Exactly.
All right. Right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland. 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Saturday, November 19th at 7 p.m., you can participate in Telebration 2011 at Cleveland Metro Park's Canalway Center in Cuyahoga Heights. Telebration is a worldwide celebration held on the Saturday before Thanksgiving as people around the world gather in cities, towns, and villages to celebrate the ancient art of storytelling. This free evening of storytelling is suitable for adults and children ages 8 and up. More information at 440-734-6660. Or at telebration.org.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist after a short break, and it's time for the news.
Yes, it is. Commutebybike.org?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very nice website, by the way.
Yeah.
Lots of good stuff on there. And we begin our news with a short commuting story. And I like the story because it demonstrates the obvious, if you think about it. And it emanates from Binghamton, New York, where some of our family lives.
Okay.
Okay. Which was, by the way, underwater not too long ago. So it seems that Matthew D. Johnson, who's a PhD psychologist, associate professor at Binghamton University in New York had some experiences with his commute from work through the university campus that made him think about headlamps and the to be seen or to see by sort of issue.
Mm-hmm.
On one evening, he encountered wet leaves and he made it through unscathed. Another evening, he mused about the salamander ramps, which allow migrating salamanders easy ingress and egress crossing the roads at Binghamton University.
Okay.
And the ramps are lumps of asphalt that might take out an unfamiliar cyclist who also has no 2C headlamp.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dr. Johnson evidently made it through the salamander crossings only to have a deer run with and then in front of him, but he saw the doe and avoided a crash with her.
Mm-hmm.
His luck ran out, however, when recent weather, meaning the historic flooding in Binghamton, removed a chunk of pavement right at the corner that is at the bottom of a hill.
Ooh.
He said, "I like to whip around that corner to get some speed for the next hill." Unfortunately, the flooding had removed a large chunk of pavement and replaced it with gravel. Because I only had the be seen headlight, I never saw it coming and went down hard.
Wow.
He goes on to say, after paying around $200 for the ER visit and follow-up appointment with the shoulder specialist, who told me in essence to walk it off, I realized that I could get a darn good headlight for what I just paid Binghamton General Hospital and Dr. Don't Be a Wimp. The events I've described led me to buy a 2C headlight that will arrive any day now. I thought that that was an interesting story.
Good
and there
plan.
Is that controversy between, you know, I always ask customers, do you want to be seen or do you want to see?
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to answer that question, I would say both.
Of course.
Of course.
Yeah,
but you'd be surprised at how many people just say, oh, no, I want to be seen until they encounter no pavement and gravel.
Well, unless you're a bat or...
Well, there is that. There is that. I left this out of our news last week because we just didn't have a lot of time, but I think it's a great piece. This is about the sperm bike.
Okay.
All right. You heard me. Used in Copenhagen since 2010, the Huffington Post reported that Seattle is now the second city to be inseminated. Hey, I'm telling you. The city known for its rainy days and the Space Needle is now home to America's first authentic sperm bike. The bike is, quote, specially designed to make speedy deliveries from the sperm bank to the clinic. The semen-shaped bike's unique storage cooling system located in its head prevents samples from becoming contaminated, KIAH-TV reports. Not only is it functional, the nearly 10-foot-long sperm bike will also make you the most popular cyclist in the bike lanes, Gary Olsom of the Seattle Sperm Bank explains. It's getting a lot of looks, you think? People are stopping. They don't quite understand what's going on. Olsom told the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, you put a giant sperm on a bike and you're going to get some attention. I know, it is funny. Evidently, fertility rates are plummeting, and the sperm banks are hoping that the unusual bike might attract attention and more donors. Enough said. It's cool looking, though. All you have to do is type in sperm bike, and I'm telling you, you'll see this funky bike. It's 10 feet long because it has this long, like, tail that comes out behind it.
I've seen them under the microscope. I know what the long tail is.
You haven't seen one with two wheels.
Does it flagellate as you pedal it down
the
road?
I have no idea.
All right, then.
Okay, are we moving on?
I think we better.
Okay, do you ever ride in a velodrome?
I have not had the pleasure yet.
Okay, so an Olympic track is 330 meters.
Okay.
And it's banked, as you know. It's fast and it's furious. It's a great sport. I wish we'd see more track racing in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
How about the smallest velodrome?
No idea.
How about an itty-bitty velodrome? Red Bull underwrote the building of the mini-drome, where a slow lap is 5 seconds and a fast lap is 3.5 seconds. It's a nutty race, and you can see a great video of it at redbull.com. Riders had 10 laps to get their times down, and 100 riders competed. All the racing's over for 2011, but hopefully we'll see more mini-dromes in the U.S. in 2012.
How long is this track?
They didn't say, but I got to tell you, they built it in a really tiny space. It's itty-bitty. And people were flying off the sides and flying down. They were laughing.
If you can do a lap in 3.5 seconds, how can you even ride a full-size bike on that?
Well, I'm telling you, it's pretty cool.
All right.
RedBull.com.
Got to check
that
out.
Yeah, you're going to like that. Okay.
All right.
Now, you know, we're going to be talking to Chef Bijou next week.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I'd let our good friend Dr. Merkin weigh in on a subject that comes up a lot in our shop and with many cyclists, salt. The common wisdom today, which might turn out to be not too wise, is that we ingest too much salt. Dr. Merkin says fitness does not reduce salt loss. A study from Spain shows that being fit does not reduce the concentration of salt in sweat. European Journal of Applied Physiology, November 2011. A person who exercises in the heat can lose far more than 4,000 milligrams of salt. So in spite of the fact that most serious exercisers get a lot of salt from the massive amounts of food they eat, they can still become salt deficient. Symptoms of salt deficiency. If you're a serious exerciser and you suddenly experience muscle weakness, soreness and cramps, loss of strength and tiredness, you may not have enough salt in your system. Get a blood test for sodium on the day after a hard workout. And if your blood sodium is below 132, I think it's something MMOL per liter, you need more salt. Dr. Merkin's always interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like his stuff. So I just thought that was interesting because we have a lot of customers who understand they need more salt. And there's a product called Salt Stick, as you know,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of other people are saying, oh, no, I can't have any salt. That's like the people who say, I don't want any fat in my diet.
Right.
And I don't want all these carbohydrates. You know what? In moderation, everything mm-hmm. is necessary to make you healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I stole something from Bike Snob NYC's blog.
Okay.
At Lindsey Wilson College in Columbia, Kentucky, the cycling coach of the well-awarded team has come up with a symbol to promote awareness to bicycle-friendly places. Coach Grigsby has created a symbol that universally would tell cyclists they could come there if they needed water, had an emergency, used the phone or the bathroom. It's simple and helps the cycling team. So he just came up with this little window sticker, sort of like the neighborhood watch sticker,
mm-hmm.
but it's a cycling-friendly sticker.
Okay. That's nice.
Bike Snob made some obnoxious comment about it, but it's nice. It's blue and white. It's very simple, and it's got this symbol on it of a bike, and it's just, you know, nice for bicyclists.
Yep.
So that's all the news for November 19th.
Okay, very
good. We're done.
Very good. And we are ready to talk about a new book.
We are. We are ready to talk to Amy Walker, who is the editor of On Bicycling, about the culture of cycling. And she's up in Vancouver, British Columbia. So let's welcome Amy to the show. Amy, thanks for joining us this evening on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very good. A little bit damp because I was just out riding in the rain.
Well, you live in Vancouver.
Yep.
Does it rain a lot?
It rains usually through the fall and winter.
Yeah.
But we've been lucky. We've had a very dry fall.
Yes. Well, we had snow this week, so what can I say? We're in Northeast Ohio. So I really am enjoying your book. And I think we can really have an interesting conversation this evening. So you're pretty much a lifelong cyclist. I read that you actually started riding your bike to school when you were 16, and it was a pretty long ride.
Yeah, it was about 45 minutes each way. So I kind of decided to be a cycle commuter when I was about 16, and I went to school across town. So it was a pretty sizable ride.
Yeah, for a 16-year-old, I'd say so. It's interesting that you sort of put yourself in the direction of your career at such a young age. You also were one of the founders of Momentum Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have this wonderful book on bicycles. So how did the book come about? It's really an interesting compendium of stories about cycling.
It's very much a culmination of my work with Momentum. So over about 10 years, we didn't publish continuously through that time, but the magazine started in 2001. And over that time, I met a lot of the writers who contributed to the book. And, you know, we built up a body of of material, so knowledge and topics around cycling. And so this book is really, it reflects a lot of what we've talked about in the magazine over that 10 years.
So you were one of the founders of Momentum. Are you still with the magazine?
Yeah, I'm still part of the magazine, but I haven't worked on the magazine for about a year now. Just shifting gears and having a change, because after a while, you know, it's good to have some new people doing things.
Right.
And so Tanya and Mia are really, like, doing all the management and running of everything. And we have an amazing team who they are still working with.
I really like the format of the book and the layout and the graphics in the paper. You and I were sort of chatting before our interview. Can you tell us a little bit about the design and how you sort of came up with the format of the book? Because it's very interesting with its little rounded corners and its nice paper.
The artwork is very much Matthew Fleming. So Matthew was an artist who, when I heard that we were going to have some illustrations in the book, I went straight to the website for Art Crank, which is a poster party for bike people. And I found Matthew's work there, and he is amazing. He draws bikes really well. That's kind of the bottom line when you're looking for a bike book illustrator, is the person has to have a good grasp of drawing bikes. And luckily, this Art Crank poster show, which has started in Minneapolis and spread to other cities, it's entirely focused on bikes. So anyone who's interested in bikes and cycling and would like to work with an artist, Art Crank is a great resource for that.
It's a cool name, Art Crank.
Yeah. Also, I should say Tracy Cunningham was the designer of the book. And really, I think the team at the publishers at New World Library worked collaboratively. They had the editor I worked with there had a good sense of sort of what he wanted to see. And then the illustrations, I think, really give it the personality that it has.
Yeah, it's got some great colors on the cover. It's just, it's sort of modern with a throwback feel to it. It's very nice. I really enjoy it. So,
yeah.
You know Stephen Belinke?
I do. I've had the pleasure to meet him at several shows that I've been to. And then he came out to Vancouver a couple of years ago, and we got to ride around on bikes in Vancouver, and he's an amazing person. And then also just as a figure in the bike world, I feel like he does an amazing thing just by just doing his art.
Yeah,
he's
a pretty cool guy. He's a pretty cool guy.
He's a fun guy. I love Stephen Belinke.
He termed your book the whole Earth catalog of bicycles. Have you ever seen a whole Earth catalog, an original?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I heard Stuart Brand talk last year in Vancouver. It was kind of, and he was the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog. And
right.
Kind of a revolutionary idea, which was basically, and I think it's high praise to say that, because I think the Whole Earth Catalog was really such a huge collection of tools and resources for people who wanted to live, you know, sustainably and just to understand sort of better how to, live in their world.
Which takes us back to the book. So the subtitle of the book is 50 Ways the New Bike Culture Can Change Your Life. And I think that the different essays about bicycling as a lifestyle offered so many perspectives. How did you decide that you would actually put this book together and then publish it as a book? What made you bring all these different aspects of sustainability and bike culture together?
Well, the impetus came from the publishers themselves. So New World Library in California, there was a fellow there, Jason Gardner, who he's a cyclist. He has a cargo bike, and so he bikes with his family. And his wife picked up a copy of Momentum at the Bike to Work Day in San Francisco, and Bike to Work Day or Bike to Work Week. And her, everyone gets a goodie bag when they do Bike to Work Day.
Right.
And so Momentum was in there, and he saw it, and he thought, well, these folks seem to be the right people to talk to about this book that I've been dreaming about. And turns out that we were, and that I was looking for something different to do. And so I went, okay, I'll sign up for that. And we started from there.
Wow, that's pretty cool that you were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, it was really good timing. And then working on the book and creating a list of the different subject areas and the areas that I thought, you know, we should really be covering, it just, you know, it all drew on that 10 years of history of putting together magazines and coming up with topic ideas and working with different writers. So it was a really great project to work on, just to sort of plumb the experience that I had.
Yeah, there are some really cool topics in the book. Part one is All the Right Reasons. And, you know, you get things like Because It's Fun and Cycling is Faster and Less is More by Amy Walker, by the way, which and that would be you. And it goes on gearing up and community and culture and getting serious. So it just covers so many cool topics. One of the things in the subtitle, Bike Culture Can Change Your Life, is intriguing. What do you see as new, and how has it become such a big force in cycling, this whole idea of the bike culture?
Well, I think that the new aspect is really the transportation aspect. When people are riding their bikes to work and to school more, then it changes really, you know, how they use their bike and, you know, how much they really rely on it as a vehicle. And then the culture part is, in a way, it's a little ironic, because sometimes when we're on our bicycles, we feel isolated. We feel, you know, like if we're in a smaller town, or, you know, we don't necessarily have the sense of culture all the time. But the culture is really an important part to encouraging cycling, because, you know, cycling is great for all these good reasons. But unless we feel like we can relate to a cultural movement or to other people and hear the stories that and experiences of other people on the road, sometimes it's hard to have a sense of, you know, kind of where we are. And so I really feel like the culture part, sometimes it's just natural, it's just there, but often it's something that we work at to encourage one another.
Well, and one of the things that really pleased me was to see how many women contributed to the book. I think that women are taking the culture of bicycling and moving it sort of in the direction it's going. So do you think women bring something new to the table when it comes to cycling?
Well, yes and no. I mean, women have different needs and demands in their lives. So when and women are generally, I mean, in North America, they're a much smaller proportion of the bike commuters. But when women start to use bikes as their transportation, you know, the transportation has to fit their lives and has to work to suit their needs. So one of the things that women often do is they take children to and from, you know, school or daycare. They do a lot of shopping. You know, they are often, and maybe I'm making a generalization here, but I'm going to say it, I think sometimes women are a little less competitive about their cycling or activities. So
I don't think that that's I don't think that that's a far reach, personally.
Yeah, so I just the sort of the way that women relate to the activity is going to change the nature of it. And, I mean, I think what I hear more often from women, I do hear it from men, too, but I hear from women that sometimes they don't feel safe riding on the road with cars. And so that, to me, it underlines the need for the, you know, more separated bike lanes and bikeways, so that there's really a designated place on the road for us, because often what cyclists have been doing is just fitting ourselves into the road with the regular stream of traffic, and that's not going to work for, you know, a lot of people, including, you know, women, including, I mean, not all women, but certainly, you know, that's what I'm hearing, and then older folks and little kids. So maybe you've heard this, Enrique Peñalosa from Bogota had a quote of, you know, you should be able to accommodate riders from 8 to 80.
Right.
And I think that's a good guideline
right.
for what's acceptable in terms of facilities.
So I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Amy Walker, the editor of On Bicycles, 50 Ways the New Bike Culture Can Change Your Life. Some of the topics in the book help beginners who can become regular cyclists. And then there's history of bicycle advocacy. And there are so many different aspects of the book. Can you highlight a couple that might not be so familiar or obvious to the average cyclist, something in the book that they wouldn't be familiar with?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the chapters that I wrote in the book is called Sharing Biking Through Culture. And that's something that I feel like I've thought about a lot in the last several years, just regarding the way that we portray cycling in our magazines and our books and our movies and TV shows and that sort of thing. I feel like cycling has entered our consciousness in a way, and it's coming out in, you know, the storylines and the stories that we tell ourselves. And I always feel like that's kind of an interesting one because, you know, it's not something you necessarily think about, but it's there in the background. But I always notice. I notice particularly bicycles popping up in advertisements. So, you know, if you see an ad for a funny one lately is a lot of, like, pharmaceutical drugs. Oh, you have a bicycle in there, and some ads for banking or RSPs. And, you know, it's the bicycle kind of is, you know, or a picture of a cyclist on your grocery store flyer. And it's, they're not selling bikes, but they're the lifestyle and the sort of the freedom and, you know, any number of things is being used there. And the bicycle is symbolizing something to people. So I think that's a really interesting one. And there's one that I also love. It's called Notes from a Bicycle Bodhisattva, which is by my co-founder of Momentum, Carmen Mills. And it sort of outlines, you know, this underlying, you know, spiritual aspect or the sort of freedom inherent in riding a bike. And so I like these sort of philosophical adventures that we go on in the book. And then there's, you know, aside from the very practical stuff, that's good too.
Any comedy in the book?
Well, yeah. There's a writer named Lars Geller.
Yes.
And he is always, I find his stuff really amusing. So he wrote a chapter about wearing lights on your bike. And, you know, it's a very practical, down-to-earth thing, but he makes it fun.
Now that this book is done and you're sort of in the realm of promoting the book, what else are you doing?
What else am I doing? Well, trying to do as much that's kind of practical and hands-on in a sense. Like, I am also, like you, I'm sort of the frustrated artist. I'd like to do more in that sense because I feel like I've been editing and working with really talented artists, and I'm like, oh, I'd like to do more of that sort of thing myself. Plus, I've worked in a bike shop the last almost year. So I've taken some shifts in a bike shop, and it's really helping me understand the exactly when the rubber hits the road, when someone wants to get a bike and what sort of questions they're asking.
Are you doing mechanical work, or are you doing basically working with the customer?
Working with the customers, selling bikes and just, you know, enjoying the culture of the bike shop.
It's given
me a lot of respect for what a variety of things a bike mechanic has to do in a day.
It is quite an interesting business, but it's always nice to hear women being in the bike shop. I think it makes a big difference to the bike shop culture.
Too.
You know, and I'm glad to hear that's what you're doing. So any new projects on the horizon?
Well, I do have, I've been working with a friend, Pierre, on creating videos. So I've got a little bike TV show video idea, which it takes a while. So we've been working on that and filming things, and it's pretty fun, but it's I can't say it's, you know, coming out anytime soon. But on our blog, the onbicycles.com blog, hopefully we'll have some little short videos to share soon.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah,
so you're going to actually...
I think it's very immediate. Like, you know, biking is out there in the world, and you can't share everything on the printed page. I think sometimes you just have to show it.
Well, and I think today everybody wants things so instantaneously that if you can hit a button and see something and be entertained, that's what this sort of new culture's all about. So do tell us how you can get a copy of the book, where it's available, and also about, I didn't realize there was an On Bicycles blog.
Yep. The book is available through your local bookstore. So
okay.
It's distributed around the U.S. and Canada. It is also available on Amazon.com or .ca, and so you can order a copy there. And anyone who orders on Amazon, please put a review up. We love that. The blog is onbicycles.com. I've been, you know, doing a little bit of a couple of readings and events and that sort of thing, and I'm really glad to talk to people like yourself on the radio.
Well, are you going to be in Sacramento at the NABS show?
I hope that I can do that.
That would be fun.
I'm not sure. I love NABS. I absolutely love that show.
Yeah, me too.
But we'll see.
Okay.
We'll see what happens with budgets and all that sort of thing. Hope to be able to make it.
Well, I really am excited to have been able to talk with you about your new book, and I wish you lots of luck. Enjoy your reading. I know it's probably going to be fun having people listen to you read. I assume you're reading from the book.
I'll do a little bit of reading from the book. Couple slides, and then what I really like to do is have a discussion with the people who show up. So if we have about 25 people there, all of them have experiences and they have their reasons for coming, and I really want to know, you know, what do they want to know? And maybe we can offer some support
okay.
to each other.
Well, maybe we'll catch up at NABS if you can go. And
yeah, that would be great.
And I will make sure that we put a link to the blog up on our Facebook page.
Okay. Well, and thank you for having me on your wonderful show. And I know that you do really good work getting the news out and informing people about what's going on in the cycling world. So thanks
well,
for that.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Have a great evening, Amy.
Okay. Bye, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Amy Walker joined us from Vancouver, British Columbia, and she's the proud editor of a new book called On Bicycles.
Really a cute book.
I love the title. You know, it works on two levels because it's, you know, we're on bicycles as in riding on them.
Right.
And then the book is on bicycles as in
about
bicycles. Yes,
yep.
I love that.
I know.
And it is a great design. I was flipping through it during the interview, and it just seems like the people who bike are so creative. You know?
Yeah. I love the poster thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to look into that.
Well, we're wrapping up for this week, getting ready for the Thanksgiving holiday. You're getting ready to head over to New York for some R&R.
We are indeed.
All right. But we do have a show cooking, so to speak, for next Saturday. So make sure to join us for that. And in the meantime, if you get some good weather on your days off, go for a ride.
Oh, Thanksgiving ride is always nice to work off all that food.
That's right.
Yeah.
And if you find a place away from the malls, you probably do a Black Friday ride if you're inclined.
Right. Stay away from the stay away from the mall.
That's right.
All right.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.